Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. You don't always need the best equipment to produce the best art, nor do you need a wealthy patron to support it. A case in point, a little bit later in this program. What you do need, though, is talent, and that's something author, poet, and activist Maya Angelou had in abundance. She traveled a long and winding road after her early days in her native St. Louis. Remarkably, her story has never been told in a documentary film treatment until now. The new film, Maya Angelou and Still I Rise, will have its St. Louis premiere tonight at 7 o'clock at the Missouri History Museum. Joining me in studio to talk about that film and Maya Angelou is Rita Coburn-Wack, the co-director of And Still I Rise. Rita, so nice to have you here.
Thank you for having me, Don.
You excited about tonight's event?
Oh, very excited. And I think Dr. Angelou would be very happy that we were doing something in her hometown.
This is the right place to do that, for sure. Let's begin by my asking you to explain your relationship to Maya Angelou. This must be a labor of love for you.
It is a labor of love. I think my relationship started, like many people, by reading her works and by being African American and reading her works in maybe about 1970. One of the things that I realized was that her voice was a voice that wasn't in my library, so that Pippi Longstocking and Encyclopedia Brown were there, but I didn't see any little black girls and I didn't see any grown women writing books. So my absolute first thing was to brave the divide between the jail on one side of the Village Hall and the library on the other, which is shaky ground for a 10-year-old. And to find that book on the shelf and reading it changed my life. I was alternately happy and also embarrassed that things were told about what seemed to be things that should have been kept in the village. And then in years later, like yourself, I worked for public radio and I interviewed Maya Angelou on at least two books. And I had that experience. And then I began to work for her with Oprah Radio as a producer with Oprah and Friends. And then I, when that ended, I took her to public radio for three Black History Month specials and became a trusted friend. So I know that's a long answer to it, but it's been both a professional and personal relationship and ended up being a mentorship, a friendship, and just a lot of respect there.
Well, tell us about her. I mean, what was she like? Most people know of her but don't know her. You do, and this is a great chance for us to get to know her a little better through you.
I think the first thing that comes to mind is how generous she really, really was. And when I say that, I don't mean generosity on a small scale, but on a very deep spiritual level. The first time that I came to her home, Miss Winfrey wanted me to go down and tape for 2 or 3 days enough shows for her to have a weekly show. And when I came to her home, she looked at me and she said, "You're so-so and tutu and everything's going to be fine, dear. In a moment, we're going to have a lot of fun. You won't need a hotel. You'll stay with me. You'll have this room as long as you come. You can raid the refrigerator and I will cook for you and we will sing and talk together. When I travel, you can join me." And it was just immediate.
Wow.
Open your home. And she would read passages of work she was working on, because this was from 2006 to 2010. Mm-hmm. And people would call. President Clinton would call. Sonia Sanchez, the poet, and Andrew Young would stop by. And they might be there for the weekend. And so many things would happen. And she would engage you around her dinner table. She was also tough. She was always teaching. And so there might be 10 feet between you and her, and behind her maybe somebody that was staying there, or it could be someone who, one of her household helpers in the kitchen or something. And everybody knew that sooner or later you were going to get it. she was going to take something that you said and take you to task. And when it happened, the person who was behind her would point and have quite a bit of a jolly because you were the person, as opposed to them. And every once in a while, she would realize this and turn around and say something like, "So we're making sport of Miss Wack today." Mm. And so she had that thing that she was always teaching, but she was very generous. And I think that she realized the gravity of something that had been put upon her, that she was just doing what she did. But there would be times when she would talk and she would marvel that people were stopping what they were doing to listen to what she had to say. And I was also with her as her health had begun to decline. And she would take me somewhere and say, "I want to show you old Winston-Salem." And we would get there and she would say, "I can't go on. Please go and look at this and go do that," and so on. And she was realizing her age. So it was a wonderful time to be with her. And I would joke with her because my mother is 93. And so at the time when she was alive and I would tell her my mother's age, she would say, "Then I guess I'm a teenager." And I would tell her I liked my women over 80. When I first met her, she was in her 70s. But that was because of the amount of wisdom that these older women had. And she had it in excess.
How did you take this, your own personal recollections of her, plus her history before you and she got together? How do you take that and translate it to film?
I think that film has its own structure, and being a filmmaker that was interested in more content than just film. So I've always been, I feel like I meet her at the place of being a griot, of wanting to tell the history. And a lot of filmmakers that get into documentary are frustrated historians. I don't think we have the patience for all of the history, but we want to tell it right. And so I think that you have a couple of things. You have the framework of what film is. Unlike this is theater of the mind and the ear. And so everybody gets to put a personal frame of reference to the story and to my voice and to your questions. In a film, I'm going to concretize some things with images. And so I have to be very careful. We went through 4,000 images to come up with 310, 750 hours of video and film to come up with the 29 minutes of it that's cumulatively in this hour and 53-minute structure. And then to take your personal relationship, she never saw the end product. Her family did, and they had no say in it. They could only come up with a fact check. And so I had free rein with that. And that was an awesome responsibility because I both wanted to respect her. And then you don't do a hagiography. So, you know, you have to work very, very hard.
I would assume that the early life, the early stages would have been difficult to put together. Or am I wrong?
You're wrong and you're right. The issues that we had. And this is a co-direction, so you have two people and what they bring to the table. And then you have the fact that no matter what you do, filmmaking is the view of the filmmakers. And the subject, to the extent that the filmmakers can extract that. So one of the things that happened to us in you know, putting the film together was she documented her own life in 7 memoirs. Mm-hmm. So she did the early years. And she did, you know, Cage Bird was where everything started. But Gather Together in My Name was right afterwards. And it was the years of 17 to 19. Mm-hmm. So she documented the early years. Now, from a filmmaker point of view, the question becomes, what do you show? I would not worry about that. I could not be contained by that. I had to tell the story first and worry about how to cover the footage later, so that if I heard the story and knew that that part of the story needed to be in, I had to put my hat on that. And we did find, wonderfully so, a couple of people that knew her in those early years. Mm-hmm. We found a dancer, wonderful man in his 80s, who opened for her in Las Vegas. We found a person who is going to be there tonight who was her roommate in Ghana. And so it came together that we were able to tell that story, and we found some photographs, and then we used some recreations.
Oh.
Yeah, because we needed to do that. So we give a lot of weight to the first part of her life because it was very important to her. And then we found her speaking about it on German television, the BBC, and brought that all together.
I ask about that because it was a very rough start for Maya Angelou, wasn't
it? Absolutely.
Yeah. But tell us about the St. Louis days and then removal from St. Louis.
So when Maya Angelou was born in 1928 in St. Louis, you're looking at a time period where we have to contextualize you and bring you back from your 2016 to how rough and tumble life was. Mm-hmm. Now, her mother was what you would call a good time girl, and they lived what you would call the sporting life. Mm-hmm. And so there was a lot of gambling. There was a lot of liquor. There was a lot of fighting. And that's the time period. It was the Wild Wild West, in a sense. She was then shortly after taken into the Jim Crow South to be with her paternal grandmother. And so now there she is in a place where lynchings and the Klan is there. And she has to stay with cripple Uncle Willie and her grandmother, but her grandmother has this carriage that is the exemplification of faith, of Christian faith, and she raises her there, which is juxtaposed to her mother. Mm-hmm. And so that was in the early years, which you can tell when she goes back in the 30s to St. Louis and is raped here by the mother's boyfriend. The terror of that and the fact that people didn't say, well, you need 5 years of counseling. Mm-hmm. You just got shipped back to the grandmother. And so there was rape, there was rejection, there was abandonment, and all of that in the context of racism. So I would say you're right. She had a rough and tumble start.
It certainly sounds like it to me. We have to take a break. We'll do okay. that now. My guest in studio is Rita Coburn-Wack, co-director of Maya Angelou and Still I Rise. It's going to be showing at 7 o'clock tonight at the Missouri History Museum. Everyone is welcome. There's plenty of room, and the film will be shown at that time. We'll come back and continue our conversation with Rita in just a moment. If you'd like to be a part of it, give us a call at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. We'll take an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org, or if you would prefer a tweet, we'll take that at STL on Air. Back in a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. I wanted to bring up the early days of Maya Angelou because the question I have in my mind, who's someone that gets off to that kind of a start, how do they emerge intact? Which, of course, she was. I mean, she was remarkably so. Do you have any theories on that?
I think there were three women that were very more than influential in her life. I think that they gave her the basis for her existence. And that was the fact that after being abandoned and being raped, she went back to her paternal grandmother, who rooted her in her faith and who gave her hope and also palpably loved her, not physically. She would tell me that she never hugged her or kissed her or said she loved her, but she would have her come into the room and tell the women that gathered at the store, look at those arms. Aren't they the most beautiful? Sisters, say your multiplications, and she can add up anything. And somebody believed in her. The other person was Mrs. Flowers, who, like all of us, was all of us probably had at least one great teacher. And so this was the woman that, after she stopped speaking, read poetry to her and came to her and encouraged her that she could eventually use her voice, and she was responsible for her to speak again. And then I think the third person was her mother, who was not a good mother to her when she was a child. She had abandoned her, but her mother came back into her life. And so I think that all of us have these lives that, you know, people say, one writer says, when you enter a home, it's the last frontier. You don't know what's happening there. And so you don't know what happened all to this young girl, but I think those three people anchored her, and I think they gave her hope, and she was able to hold on and have wisdom. And the other thing that made her rise outside of that is, you will note that she said that she read all the books in the Black library and all the ones she could get from the white library. So between the ages of 7 and 13, she'd read Balzai, Guy de Maupassant. She'd read all of Shakespeare, all of Poe. Like James Baldwin, she was that self-educated. People come out with PhDs without that. And of course, she's never had a degree. She's got honorary doctorates, but she was self-educated. And when she read all that information, I think that that gave her the intelligence and that we hear from her.
You know, you have to wonder with people like Maya Angelou, if she had never been exposed to a library, what might she have been?
I don't know. Yeah. I would, in a time period where we're limited to 140 characters on Twitter and we say things without any real depth to them, I think that reading has lost a lot of luster for some people, but it seems to be an equalizer in the education basic that can change people's lives. And I think that that changed her life. She could get lost in a book. She could go somewhere different than where she was. She could escape her reality temporarily. Like I say, with radio being the theater of the mind, and you take your personal reference, here was a little girl who thought that Edgar Allan Poe was Black. She found the rhythm of his work Once Upon, you know, she got that. And she said that she looked at Shakespeare, like, how did he know her, a little Black girl in Arkansas? Mm. So she was able to live through some traumatic moments by escaping through another reality.
There was not a eureka moment then in which she said, this is what I'm going to do with my life. Clearly, it was an evolution.
It was an evolution.
Yeah.
It was an evolution.
What about some of the other seminal moments in her life? What would they have been? Was the civil rights movement a part of that? Or were there instances or situations before that that really impacted her?
I'd say both. I think where civil rights is concerned, she has a quote that said when she heard about, when she saw Martin Luther King, she was so taken by him that he was absolutely irresistible. It was as if she was in a parched desert and there he was and she was ready for him. She says that she had seen so much violence and herself being violated that when his message of nonviolence came, she was ready for that. Now, unlike many people, she was able to forge a relationship with both Martin Luther King and Malcolm X, who were really diametrically opposed.
Absolutely.
At the time. And she loved Malcolm X because she realized his intelligence. She met him when he came to Ghana, along with a number of expats. And she was with him as well as with Dr. Du Bois. And so she was around these people who gave their life to a movement without thinking about it. They, when they got in there and realized how what the cost was, they were in too deep to back up. So I think that she formed relationships with them, and she saw that there was a greater good. There was also a point prior to what we call the civil rights movement, which some of us may say started with Rosa Parks, but there was a part in the 50s and the 60s before 68, which we all claim now, that people who were working on this dream, they believed that it could happen, and it was so across color lines, and we get that confused. Jules Pfeiffer, the cartoonist, was a friend of hers at the time, and along with being in rooms with Thomas Wolfe or with Philip Roth, and she was listening to great thinkers, and they all didn't, people didn't know them when she was in the Broadway off-Broadway play, The Blacks, which started avant-garde theater, some would say, in this country. She was in with Cicely Tyson, James Earl Jones, Charles Gordon, and Lou Gossett Jr., and none of them had names. Mm-hmm. They were the people that hung out together. So she was really a part of that upper air before it was known that these would be people who would go out and do great things.
You know, if you wanted to back up, I suppose you could go back to 1948, the integration of the military, and then go to Brown versus Board of Education, the civil rights, and certainly go well beyond that as well. Philip Randolph and all the rest of those people
Pullman
involved.
The Pullman Porters and the movement, yes.
But mm-hmm. it really got a powerful head of steam in the 60s.
I would say for her, mm-hmm. so you're looking at 1928 being born. By the time she gets back to St. Louis, say 35, she may only be 7 years old, but she's actually in the middle of the Great Migration. Mm-hmm. And so her sensibility of where she was wasn't necessarily overt, but that's where she was. And she made those moves in history so that, you know, who did this? In the 50s, she traveled with the State Department around the world, in Egypt, in many places that no one in that was the time when if people took a plane trip somewhere, the mother would go on one plane and the father on another. You'd have to get the context of the time. But here she was, having lived for a short period in Hawaii, having lived in California and Oakland, and then going around the world with going to places that most people didn't go to, and then living in them, and then being a part of the arts movement in New York. So I think the well-roundedness of her life, and then the fact that I think she was probably less fearful because she had read about all these things, and now she was able to actually be in the middle of them.
Boy, what a remarkable life when you think of all the twists and turns and what it ultimately became. You've mentioned Ghana a couple of times. I'm not sure that everybody understands what that part of her life was all about.
Well, the first thing that happened to her was she in about 60, 61, when she was doing the off-Broadway play, The Blacks, which was really Jean Genet, the French writer. It was his statement about the absurdity of racism in this country and internationally. She then toured not only with the State Department and Porgy and Bess, that was over, and that's where she met James Baldwin, but she met a man who we call her second husband, but I don't think that it was ever, you know, a real marriage. It was a common law marriage. And Vus Maki was a West African freedom fighter. And he was a fighter all over the world at that time. And so they fell in love, and he had her move with him to Cairo. And so they were in Cairo, And let's say they fell out of love. And there she was in Cairo. And she made her way to Ghana. And Alice Wyndham, who's going to be on the panel tonight, was her roommate in Ghana. And so that's how we put that part of the story together. And so when she made her way to Ghana, she was actually en route to a job that she had in another African country, but I'm not going to tell you, but you'll see this in the film, but emergency situation occurred, and she stayed in Ghana. And Ghana, at the time of Nkrumah, was a very exciting place to be. And she began to write for newspapers and work and live in Ghana. And so at that particular time in the culture, that's how she got there.
You certainly had plenty to work with.
Okay. poverty of riches. There was so much. And we know we did the best we could. And we know that we could not keep as many things as we wanted to. And our rubric became, it needed to be about her. So people will ask, what happened to her brother? What happened? One of the ways we could focus and funnel down and create a filter was to make sure that it was about her life.
We only have a little time left. Tell us about tonight. It's more than just the showing of the film.
Yes, we're very excited to show the film in the place of her birth. And we know that she has many friends here and also many researchers, librarians helped us with the story. They'll be there. And Alice Wyndham and Dr. Eugene Redman, a friend of hers for many years since the 70s, local poet, he will be there. And so we'll all be on the panel afterwards for questions.
All righty. Well, it sounds like it's going to be a great evening, and we've just barely scratched the surface during our 30, 35 minutes together. But, Rita, thank you so much for being with us. Congratulations on the film, and best of luck with it.
Thank you, Don.
That's Rita Colburn-Wack, co-director of Maya Angelou and Still I Rise, the documentary film about Maya Angelou, of course. It's premiere tonight, St. Louis premiere at 7 o'clock at the Missouri History Museum. Also now, another local artist talking about her crowd-funded book, Reappearances. That's next. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.